In the Good Job Brain system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the quizzers who pose questions and the brave men and women who answer them. These are their stories.
Hello, compellingly compassionate community composed of compadres, comma, commuters, comma, and competitors. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. Today's episode is 213. I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your procession of proactive, prolific pros providing pros about prostate and prosciutto.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. I would like to pose this question to our listeners. Do you enjoy listening to Good Job Brain? Because if in fact you do, and maybe you don't, maybe you're doing this to punish yourself, if you actually enjoy listening to Good Job Brain and you want to hear more Good Job Brain that is not Good Job Brain, for the first time ever, the entire Good Job Brain cast was a guest. One guest formed out of the bodies of four people on an upcoming, it was super gross, on a podcast you can listen to right now. It is called Escape This Podcast. Where the hosts come up with a escape room full of puzzles that we play in podcast form. We had a blast doing it. It was actually the season finale of this whole story arc, and we got to be the final guest closing out this epic story that was running through, I think, 10 different episodes. It involved Neil Patrick Harris at one point. Neil Patrick Harris was actually on this show. Involved two out of the three McElroy brothers. It was really just a whole, there were multiple contestants from Survivor, and then us.
We made it out.
I think that you, person listening to Good Job Brain, should also check out this episode. You might want to listen to the whole arc.
I say start at the beginning and just enjoy it. It's very good. Yeah. And it's put on by Bill and Danny, who are two Good Job Brain listeners. They are hardcore trivia people who have been on numerous Australian trivia-related TV shows. So there are kind of people. Danny is the one who makes the puzzles, and they are so good and so fun.
A lot of this stuff we're hearing for the first time, and so we're taking notes, we're drawing maps. It just was so original. We had so much fun. Chris's son got mad at Chris because we recorded past our time because we were having so much fun.
Yeah, there's actually two things to listen to because it's Escape This Podcast, and then there's it's also Podcast This Escape, the spinoff show that they do where they talk to us about the puzzles that we just did, which is like also, I think, show. Worth listening to. Yeah.
Oh, and one more thing. They release the puzzles every week. Or every episode. So that way you could run the puzzles with your friends if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yep. So give it a listen. Thank you, Bill and Danny, for inviting us and letting us solve your amazing puzzles. We had so much fun, and hopefully we'll do it again sometime.
Yes. Hopefully. Invite us back, please.
Without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. Here I found my random Trivial Pursuit card. You guys have your barnyard buzzers. Let's answer some questions. Blue Wedge, for geography, the cities of Indio and Palm Springs are located in which California valley? Whoa, that was Dana.
Death Valley?
Incorrect.
Oh.
Chris.
Simi Valley?
Incorrect. Guys all heard this name. Probably didn't know it was a valley. Oh.
Coachella?
Coachella. Mm-hmm. Home of the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival. Oh. Pink Wedge. Bam Bam is the son of which Stone Age couple? Colin.
Bam Bam is the son of Barney and Betty Rubble.
Correct. Yes. I didn't know you spell BAMM-BAMM.
Oh, four M's.
Yellow Edge, leaders of 175 nations gathered at the UN in April 2016 to sign the Paris Agreement, a global pact to fight what? Colin?
Global warming or emissions, or I don't know how it was worded, but I believe climate change. Right? Climate change these days. That's right.
Purple Wedge, Mr. Smee is the bumbling sidekick of which literary villain? Chris.
Captain Hook.
Captain Hook from Peter Pan. Green Wedge for Science and Nature. What's the common name for the third molars inside a human mouth? Chris.
Wisdom teeth.
Yes.
Oh, a human mouth.
Third counting backwards. Gotcha.
Third counting backwards. Yeah, that's why I was like, that makes so much sense. All right, last question, Orange Wedge. What is the most followed sport in India? It is multiple choice, but I think we can get it. But Chris buzzed in.
Cricket.
Cricket as well. Okay, all right. What were the other choices they gave us? I'm just curious.
Other choices were badminton, soccer, or tennis.
Oh.
No,
cricket is by
cricket,
far
easy choice. So- there,
soccer was the Joe Bloggs answer there. Yeah.
Ooh, good job, everybody. All right, guys. Today's episode. I want to ask you. Back in November 2015, the Collins English Dictionary chose what word to be the word of the year?
Ooh.
And it's an activity.
Oh.
You didn't have to buzz it. Colin, please.
Is it binge watch?
Binge watch.
Yep.
Binge watch. Word of year 2015. That's like 6 years ago, but it seems pretty recent. I don't know. This is all thanks to streaming services, especially Netflix, releasing all the episodes of a season at once. So before the term was marathon viewing. But I think that's tied to like TV channels doing like, oh, I'm doing a Lord of the Rings marathon.
I think it's also tied to healthy behavior versus what it really is like when you're watching a bunch of shows at once.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
Marathon versus binge.
No, I am watching a marathon.
I'm just doing a marathon.
SBU.
Yeah.
So, of course, one of our favorite pastimes, things we like doing, is watching TVs, watching shows, watching stuff on our screens. So this week, it's a watch party.
TV party tonight! TV party tonight!
Oh, we got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews.
Don't want to talk about anything else.
We don't want to know.
We're dedicated, yes,
to our favorite shows.
Okay, I'll go first. Back in the spring of 2015, just a few years into season one of Good Job Brain, we had our 150th episode, and that was an all-quiz bonanza. I know, can you believe it? And I mentioned during this all-quiz bonanza a funny description of a movie that once appeared in a newspaper's TV listing. Let me dial that back a little bit for the kids. Probably know what a newspaper is, but the TV. But if you wanted to watch the movie on the TV, it would be on at a certain time. So you have to go get a physical newspaper.
match it up.
You'd have to leave your house and go to a buy the newspaper, open it up, and look down the paper, and it would say that such and such a movie was going to be on TV at that time, and then you had to be there to watch it. And
when you describe it that way, it sounds insane.
You're like, why would anyone bother?
It's
the only entertainment that existed then.
Exactly. It's jumping through a lot of hoops to watch a cut up ass version of a 5-year-old movie, but we did it. Then of course, inside the newspaper would be a description of the, because again, how would you know what the movie was about? You'd have to read a small description of the film to see if this was something that you might want to invest your time into. And there was a description of a film in a newspaper's TV listing, and it read, "Transported to a surreal landscape, a young girl kills the first person she meets, then teams up with three strangers to kill again." And this was, of course, a description of the
movie,
Wizard of Oz. Yes.
Yeah.
This was a very funny description of the film written by a comedy writer named Rick Polito, who to this day still does these funny off-kilter descriptions for a newspaper called the Pacific Sun, which is here in the Bay Area. And
printed.
Printed, yes. Still it's an all weekly. It's a printed newspaper. Yes. So anyway, with the theme of this episode, I thought it would be fun to revisit, do a round two, Rick Pulido's description of the film, and you tell me the film.
All right.
Some of these, folks, are going to be a little more difficult than last time, so I'm also going to give you the year of the film in case you need to narrow it down a little bit.
Do you think it's because the plot description is harder, or the movie is more obscure?
Sometimes both.
Okay.
Sometimes the plot description might not have quite enough information. But then additionally, it's also some of these movies, when they came out in 2003, everybody was talking about them, but 2003 was a long time ago, and maybe we've forgotten some of these sort of
Don't say that.
Yeah, I know. So let's see how you do. Question one. This is a buzz-in quiz. 2001. A short guy with hairy feet goes camping with his Renfair friends in order to complete a jeweler's complicated return policy. Colin.
Would that be the Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring?
Yes, Lord of the Rings, the Fellowship of the Ring. I called on you because I knew I could count on you to deliver both the title and the subtitle of the film.
Thanks.
I guess that's true. I would have said Lord of the Rings one.
1983. A son helps his father share his true feelings and confront an emotionally manipulative supervisor. Karen.
Mary Poppins.
Oh, not for 1983. Oh. No,
okay.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's too late.
this is the.
Okay, it has a kid.
A son helps his father share his true feelings and confront an emotionally manipulative supervisor.
Oh my gosh.
Colin.
1983. That is Star Wars: Return of the Jedi.
Exactly. Oh. Thank you so much.
Oh my gosh.
Great work on that one. All right.
That's great.
2007. In the sequel, treasure hunter Benjamin Gates discovers a book kept by the president with the answers to such mysteries as the JFK assassination, the Roswell incident, who shot JR, and whether there is a role Nicolas Cage would turn down. Karen?
National Treasure: A Book of Secrets.
Exactly. Yes. Very good. National Treasure: Book of Secrets. Yes. Yes. Nice. Nice job. Okay. We're doing good. Okay. 2018.
Oh, okay.
Yes. A sociopath goes jewelry shopping.
2018.
A sociopath goes jewelry shopping. Jewelry collecting might be.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Avengers Endgame? Is it that one? The one with Thanos and he has all the...
Oh no, Infinity War.
I cannot give you a point for Endgame. I'm sorry. Avengers Infinity War. 1989. Another woman gives up her career for a man. 1989. Karen.
Pretty Woman.
It is not Pretty Woman.
Oh,
that would have been good. Probably the biggest animated film of 1989.
Oh.
Little Mermaid.
Yes, yeah. The Little Mermaid.
1989.
Yep. Wait, what was her career, though?
She was a singer.
That's true.
Yes, it seemed like an antique collector.
She was a singer. That was why she gave up her voice, because her voice was her big talent.
Okay. I think of her as like an antique collector.
Right. That was her side hustle. All right. 1994. Unable to find funding, a visionary doctor is forced to conduct his research in a rundown castle, but is able to accommodate his lab assistant's posture deformity and make important discoveries. Dana.
Young Dr. Frankenstein? No.
It is not Young Frankenstein.
Young Frankenstein.
The classic Mel Brooks film. No, that is not 1994. Oh. And I need the full title of this film.
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
That's it. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Trying to capitalize on the success, of course, of Bram Stoker's Dracula from a couple of years prior.
94?
94. Okay. Mary Shelley's
Was that the Kenneth Branagh one?
Yeah, okay. And Robert De Niro.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
The monster.
I saw this one in the theater, man. Yeah,
and Julia Roberts.
played Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Well, she gave up her job for a man's
for
monster.
A man.
Yep. Yep. 2015, cancel culture activists call for the end of a popular reality TV show. 2015.
Okay.
Cancel culture activists call for the end of a popular reality TV show. And this, again, I will accept nothing less than the exact specific title
it's
of this
be,
film.
Come on, yeah, go ahead.
You guys are so good.
It's got to be one of the Hunger Games ones.
Oh, okay. Oh. Cancel. So it must be Hunger Games,
the last one.
Mockingjay.
Is it Mockingjay, the last one?
I'm throwing the ball up there. You guys got to alley-oop at home.
Don't give us sports analogies, man. Didn't Mockingjay have two parts?
Oh, it was part two, probably.
I say the part one.
Dana says part two. Karen says part one. Dana gets the point. It is the Hunger Games, Mockingjay, part two. Well earned.
I just listed a bunch of stuff. I cheated.
Point for Dana.
But give me the point in the grand tally anyway.
Back to, going back to 1983, a great year for movies. A family embarks on a long and arduous journey, encountering setbacks and delays, only to find their destination closed down when they get there. In this troubling metaphor for your company's retirement plan. I think it was Karen first.
National Lampoon's Vegas Vacation.
You overthought
incorrect.
It. I think you overthought it.
Family Vacation.
Incorrect.
National Lampoon's Vacation.
National Lampoon's Vacation is the title of the original 1983.
Yeah, that was a sequel.
There is a Vegas Vacation in the 90s. Yeah, this is the one where they go to Wally World. A couple more. 1997. Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman exist in a superficial society where achievement and opportunity are based on looks. They are also in this movie about an authoritarian future. Karen.
Gattaca.
It's Gattaca.
Yes.
Made out of DNA letters, the title.
Yes.
A great joke. Again, all of these, I did not write these. These are all written by Rick Pulido.
Very good.
Very, very funny. Very funny. They make for a great quiz. Okay, a couple more. 1988. Emilio Estevez, Kiefer Sutherland, Lou Diamond Phillips, and Charlie Sheen play young outlaws on the run in the Old West, robbing trains and small-town banks to support their hair jail habit. Karen.
Young Guns.
Young Guns.
Yeah.
Yeah. And finally,
my friend was obsessed with that movie. That's her awakening as a woman, I think. That movie. That's what I think of when you said it. I was like, oh, I know what movie this is, but I didn't. That's
Finally, the last one. 1995. Is an updated telling of the rivalry between King Arthur and Lancelot really worth the risk of seeing Richard Gere in tights?
I can't imagine him.
What was either. I think that this kind of happened kind of coming off the back of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and the success there, maybe. Because I remember this being a thing. It was like this kind of sexy, like fighting over Guinevere, Richard Gere. Yeah.
Is it something just like Knights of the Round Table? I would just be guessing.
It's got the word knight in it. I don't know if you remember this. Oh,
A Knight's Tale.
Dana?
Is it First Night? Last Night?
It's First Night.
First Night.
Wow.
That's
it.
Yeah.
You got it. See, it was up there. It was up there bouncing around in the noggin. Yeah, First Night.
What's King Arthur? Who else is
Sean Connery and Richard Gere is Arthur and Lancelot.
Wow, this is so mid-90s.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Rated R? I don't think I was allowed to watch it for some
reason. Yeah, this sounds like it was a
that might be for
sexy.
The best.
Yeah. Hey, okay, great job. You guys did really good, like piecing it together from the clues. Again, Rick Pulido, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful newspaper descriptions of these films that he still does. Makes for a good quiz.
I wonder if he's on Cameo.
Maybe.
Ooh, Richard Gere?
No.
Rick Pulido. Oh, how fun. He's on Cameo. We can get him to, like, you know.
Do one.
Write summaries.
This is our only lens for viewing the world now is Cameo.
Can we get a Cameo of this? Yeah.
So, released along with this episode
this week. I prepared a mini episode that's going to come out at the same time. As many of you guys know, I was on the first season of The Chase, a game show here that was originally from the UK, and they rebooted earlier in 2021. Game shows are just naturally so interesting. So released with this episode is a special mini bonus episode where I talk to some of the people who've been on game shows and a little bit about their experience, including our Good Job Brain, now 6-time American Crossword Tournament winner, Tyler Hinman.
Yeah.
He was on Fox's Superhuman. And then we also have a Good Job Brain listener, Amy, who was on a bunch of stuff. But more importantly, most importantly, she was on Supermarket Sweep.
Yes.
That's my dream.
Yes. This is why.
Yeah.
And then speaking of The Chase, I also invited my friend Elliot, who's also a contestant on my season of The Chase. And we'll talk about our experiences, tips and tricks of how to best audition, what the process is like. So if you're curious about the inner workings of some of the game shows and our stories, be sure to tune in to our mini episode released at the same time this week. And with that said, I actually have a game show challenge for everybody. Ooh. Rapid fire. Here we go. All about game shows. We ready?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, no. I'll splice in some music, like some heart. You know, they always have like the heartbeat music. It makes you kind of nervous. Here we go. Question number one. A Time for Tony is another name for which game show's iconic theme song?
A Time for Tony.
Colin.
Jeopardy.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Oh, right.
What reality competition first debuted in Sweden under the name Expedition Robinson? Chris.
Is it Survivor?
Correct. Survivor. Mm. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego was a children's geography game show inspired by what? Dana.
A video game.
Correct. Before Drew Carey, who was the host of The Price is Right?
Oh, yeah.
Chris.
Oh.
Bob Barker.
Correct. Mm-hmm. How many briefcases are there in Deal or No Deal?
Ooh.
Chris.
50.
Incorrect.
Dana. 36.
You're close. It is 26. What physical game show is named after a surfing term for falling? Chris.
Wipeout.
Correct. Yeah. How many people are surveyed for responses on Family Feud? Dana.
100.
Correct. Mm. The popular saying, no whammy, comes from which game show? Colin.
Press Your Luck.
Correct. Pat Sajak is the host of what game show since 1981? Chris.
Wheel of Fortune.
Correct. What has been the highest value version of the pyramid?
Ooh.
Colin.
$1 million pyramid.
Incorrect. Mm. Chris. Hey.
$100,000.
Correct. $100,000 is the highest value. What game show would you give a bonus for grinding your coffee? Everybody.
Supermarket Sweep.
So biased. We're like, we love that show. Golden Medley is the main bonus round of what game show? Chris.
Name that tune.
Correct. Newsman Anderson Cooper once hosted what sneaky game show?
Ooh. Sneaky. Oh.
Colin.
The Mole.
Correct. Uh-huh. The Mole. Fantastic game show. Very,
I remember that one.
You know, peak 2000 aesthetic. What game show are you on if you had to pick a giant slime-filled nose? Dana.
Double Dare.
Correct.
And or Family Double Dare.
It's true.
It's true. The Weakest Link first appeared in what country? Dana.
UK.
Correct. Regis Philbin once was the primetime host for what game show? Dana.
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Correct. Can someone name another celebrity host?
Oh.
Dana.
Meredith Vieira.
Correct.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I also would accept Jimmy Kimmel, who is a celebrity millionaire host. And last question. What U.S. competition is based on the Japanese program called Sasuke?
Ooh.
What U.S.
Oh. Is it American Ninja Warrior?
Correct.
Oh, okay.
Good job, everybody. Da, 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 da.
Now, Karen, I have a point of order here that might preempt an actually. Did Pat Sajak not take a break from hosting the show for a while there? I believe that he hosted, took a break. They had a series of other hosts, and then Pat Sajak came back to the show with some great fanfare.
Oh, interesting. Let's look it up.
She didn't say continuously, but I think it was implied. I remember, like, at one point, like, Rolf Benersky was the host of Wheel of Fortune, I feel like.
Oh, okay. Sajak hosted the daytime series until 1989 when he left to host a late night talk show for CBS.
That's what it was. Mm-hmm. That's right. He wanted, he had you know, bigger ambitions maybe, or.
Good job, everybody. One thing I will share with you guys, the one thing that blew my mind. I mean, there are a lot of things that blew my mind being on a TV game show on primetime TV. But the one thing that really blew my mind, there was a auditor on there on taping day.
Yeah.
And his job, you know, we even got a little special talk, and his job was essentially to monitor that the game is fair.
Yeah.
Which is a nice way of saying, like, don't cheat. Yeah, we're watching you.
No shenanigans.
But also that they're an independent person and they're going to make sure that the show does not cheat you either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So
like
that
quiz show.
You know,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's because of, there's a movie in the 90s called Quiz Show about the quiz show scandals in the 1950s where people were colluding and producers kind of changing it up for ratings and became a big legal case. It implemented a bunch of laws, including this, you know, being on a game show now requires a third party auditor who comes to make sure that everything's running as fairly as possible. You know, even if you see somebody who is like, you know, maybe another contestant talking to a producer like by the dumpster or something, maybe they're just hanging out, but like it seems kind of sketchy and you're supposed to report. You have to report all these things. So if you go out to the bathroom, you have to be escorted, you know, so a lot of these things happen. And I had no idea. I was like, oh, of course, that makes so much sense. They're dealing with giving away hundreds and thousands of dollars. And so they have to make sure that it's fair for everybody. Weird, right?
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
So that's my cool tidbit. And for more production stories, check out our companion episode.
And I remember when I tried out for Jeopardy years ago, they get so many lawyers from LA that the code on Jeopardy is if they say so-and-so originally from St. Louis, Missouri,
that means
they live in LA. And if they say once worked as a bookkeeper, that's code for they're a lawyer. They get so many lawyers from LA. Yeah. And I learned that. Oh, huh. So I watched Jeopardy. Yeah. The originally from, that means they live in LA. Okay. So when this episode airs, I believe we will be just a few short weeks away from that great American secular holiday, Bobby Bonilla Day. Coming up on July 1st. It's almost upon us again.
For it's our favorite.
It is
good job, brain. Day holiday.
I love that we've adopted this day. Yeah. So for listeners who don't know or may not remember, this is sort of baseball related, but even non-baseball fans, I think, love this one. So Bobby Bonilla was a baseball player. He was released by the New York Mets more than 20 years ago now. And per the terms of the deal, he and his agents and lawyers negotiated instead of a single payment at the time. Bobby Bonilla receives a yearly payment of $1.2 million American every July 1st, starting in 2011 and running until 2035.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, this is
the dream.
It's truly the American dream, Chris.
That's the supermarket sweep of
your boss. Yeah. Your boss might lay you off, but then every year they have to send you a check for $1.2 million and get made fun of online, just like clockwork now. It's time to clown the Mets again.
This is what happens, I feel like, for him, that he's very intelligent about personal finances, but he also surrounds himself with people who are very knowledgeable with this type of stuff. It's like, wow.
Yes. Karen, you could even say Bobby Bonilla was far more knowledgeable than the Mets, who, as it turns out, lost a good amount of money to the Bernie Madoff scam. Yes, that's right. So when we decided to loop back around to the topic of television, I thought I would take a chance to share a story with you guys that I've loved for years and years and years. I think this story can appeal to anybody who loves forward-thinking negotiations and the power of television. Okay, so I can't believe I'm asking this as an intro to an ostensibly educational segment here, but have you guys seen the movie Semi-Pro with Will Ferrell?
Oh, yeah, and Andre 3000 from Outkast is in it.
That's correct, yes, Andre 3000 from Outkast is in it as well, right, right. So here, I will share the description with you. So per IMDb, Jackie Moon, the owner, coach, player of the American Basketball Association's Flint, Michigan Tropics, rallies his teammates to make their NBA dreams come true. That is a very good summary. Will Ferrell, of course, played Jackie Moon, the erstwhile soul singer, I believe, who became the owner of the Flint Tropics in the movie. Now, the movie has, you know, the usual layers of Will Ferrell silliness, and it was by no means based on a true story. But at its core, it did revolve around some very real events that were occurring in not just a fascinating time in NBA basketball pro history, but the evolution of pro sports as a modern business in the TV era. I have a story for you guys. This has been called the greatest deal in sports history.
Greater than Bobby Bonilla.
Greater than Bobby Bonilla, Karen. Wow. Greater than Bobby Bonilla. All right. So let's flash back here, shall we, to the mid-late 1960s. Now, the NBA was still in a lot of ways a rising sports league. You know,
wow.
I mean, it had been
That's
around
weird
for,
to
you
imagine.
Know, yeah, it is hard to imagine today, especially when NBA stars, arguably some of the most famous athletes in the world, maybe behind, you know, some pro soccer players. In 1967, the NBA, they only had teams in 10 cities at that point. And that year, among some other challengers to the NBA's sort of hold on professional hoops in the U.S., popped up the ABA, the American Basketball Association. So as depicted in the Will Ferrell movie, the ABA was a real basketball league. It was a challenger to the larger NBA. And ultimately, they did merge with the NBA. I will sort of jump ahead a little bit in the story. This period, like the mid to late 60s, had just seen a lot of kind of turbulence in pro sports, right? The AFL and NFL had just merged in pro football. The idea was, among the founders of the ABA, let's start a league that will eventually force the NBA to buy us out. It was like a startup mentality. They advertised to potential investors that they could basically get a new ABA franchise for half of what it cost to get an NBA franchise, because we were a little more, you know, kind of smaller seat of the pants operations. And their goal was, let's go in cities that the NBA doesn't serve, largely smaller cities. We're going to be more fun. We're going to be kind of scrappier. But ultimately, really, the goal was to get bought out. Okay.
To be enough of a competition.
That's right. They had sort of seen the model within pro football. They're like,
they
wait a minute.
They don't want to become big.
That's right. That's right. If we get big enough, it's very startup mentality, you know, today. If you're like, you're starting your software company, you might want to get bought by Google or Microsoft or somebody like that. Now, the ABA did, in fact, push the NBA to be more fun, I think, all around. The ABA came up with the three-point shot. Like, that was an ABA invention, not an NBA invention. In fact, a lot of the NBA people were pretty stodgy in those days. The ABA came up with the slam dunk contest, you know, things that just seem, you know, inextricable from modern NBA play today. They had the red, white, and blue ball, you know, that was their answer to the boring old orange leather ball of the
NBA. Did they do the thing with the trampoline?
Globetrotters.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is where the Will Ferrell movie diverges a little bit. Yeah, you were not likely to see people wrestling bears at real-life ABA exhibition games. But the ABA had a lot of players who would go on to greater fame later. The ABA gave us the world legends like Dr. J, That is where Dr. J made his name, was in the ABA before he joined the NBA. Their goal was to get bought out, but they wanted to sort of stay in business long enough to do this. It turned out that it was actually, they were having a hard time maintaining the level of support and revenue. They only had one of its teams was in a top 20 American market, you know, in New York. Oh. Aside from that, they just couldn't draw enough people. They couldn't get enough TV rights. They couldn't. So after a few years of pushing and prodding and negotiating, ultimately the NBA did agree to merge, absorb the smaller league, or most of it. Okay. By the time the talks had sort of come to the point that, like, yes, this is going to happen, there were only seven teams left in the ABA. You know, they started with, you know, almost twice that. Some of them just really couldn't keep it together and just folded outright. Some of them tried their best. For whatever reason, they were down to seven teams. And so they got together, and the owners of the seven teams basically came up. They said, like, all right, we want to get bought out. It's probably likely that the NBA will want to take six of us, but not seven of us, right? Makes scheduling easier. You can have, like, nice, even divisions and balanced and things like that. So they got together, and they wrote into their agreement, basically. They said, all right, if the NBA buys six of us, whoever is the odd team out, we will collectively agree to give the owners of that team 1/7 of whatever profits that we make from being bought by the NBA. So they're moving forward, mid-70s, late 1975, heading into 1976. As the negotiations progress, the NBA makes it clear they are going to accept four of the seven teams. They don't want six. They don't want seven. They want four. And so they wanted just the four, basically the cream of the crop. They wanted the most successful teams. They didn't want to be carrying, you know, in their minds, maybe some dead weight. So, you know, the teams that ended up merging that still exist today are the Denver Nuggets, the Indiana Pacers, the San Antonio Spurs, who, of course, have gone on to win many titles. And then at the time, they were the New York Nets. They are today the Brooklyn Nets once again. So the NBA says, we'll take four of those teams. You know, the other three kind of, y'all figure it out. Yeah. By the time the merger date came, one of the teams had just gone bankrupt entirely, just totally belly up. Now we're down to six. One of the teams, the Kentucky Colonels. Now, Chris, I believe in the past, Chris, you educated us that Kentucky Colonels as a concept existed well before the Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise.
Indeed, yes.
The team was named after the concept of the Kentucky Colonels. However, it was, in fact, owned by the owner of Kentucky Fried Chicken at the time.
Nice.
Okay.
John W. Brown.
Okay.
Synergy. So he decided, you know what? I'm just going to cut my losses here. I'm just going to take a buyout. So so John Brown Jr. took a one-time payout of $3.3 million to just waive all rights at that time. That's right. Yeah. $1975 dollars here. So now we're down to five teams. Okay. One belly up. One took a payout. So there's the four teams that I mentioned before. And then there is the Spirits of St. Louis, which was owned by the Silna brothers, Ozzie and Daniel Silna, S-I-L-N-A. Upon hearing that the NBA only wanted to take four teams, and specifically those four teams I mentioned, they were pretty mad. They're like, wait, no, we wanted to be in the NBA. And they really did. They really wanted to join the NBA and run an NBA franchise. So rather than take a one-time payout, they said, hey, wait a minute. We worked in this deal. Remember that the teams that don't make it to the NBA get a 1/7 share from the other remaining teams. Mm-hmm. So this is what, in fact, Ozzie and Daniel Silna did, is they said to the NBA, great, we will waive our claim to the team. We want 4/7 of a share of NBA team rights. And specifically, they wanted TV rights. Okay, so this is 1976. The Silnas are now out of the basketball business officially, but every year they get a share, 4/7 of one share of the NBA's TV rights. Okay. Now, that worked out to about 2% of the league's broadcasting revenue.
I was not roughly told there would be math.
Yes. I'm giving you the math.
Excuse me.
Here, right.
Okay. Say 2%.
roughly of the total leagues, but it came out of those four teams. So the Nuggets, the Nets, the Pacers, the Spurs had to chip in every year a seventh of their broadcast revenue profits, and basically it went over to the Silna brothers.
So not the league, like 1/7 of each of those four teams. They have to
That's right.
And they're good teams.
Those were good teams. And now, again, the way that league TV rights work is they pool money. Okay. And this is true for a lot of pro sports. So, you know, the Yankees TV money, you know, kind of floats the boat of some of the poorer performing teams in baseball. Mm-hmm. And the same is true in the NBA. So now, yeah, it sounds like a great deal already. Just at that, like you're getting 4/7 of a share for opening the mailbox every, you know, and cashing yeah. a check. And now this is 1976. I want to put this in perspective for you guys. TV rights were such a tiny percentage of the revenue that the NBA made compared to today.
Back then, yeah.
In the late 70s, games were still being shown on tape delay late at night, okay? NBA Finals games. In 1981, the title-clinching game was shown at 11:30 at night on tape delay after the local news. This was like, it was such an afterthought to CBS and the major networks. If you were watching your local 11 o'clock news, the sports guy would come on and be like, okay, now you might want to look away from the screen for a few minutes so you don't get spoiled on the game that has not aired yet, but I'm about to tell you who won.
Wow.
That's how small time, how small potatoes the NBA TV rights were. Yeah. So now through the 1980s, thanks to players like Magic Johnson and Larry Bird and Michael Jordan, TV rights started to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Through the 80s, it looks like through the 80s total, okay, collectively the 80s, the Silnas collected $8 million. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Not bad. Not bad. From 1990 to 1994 alone, yeah, just these 4 years alone, they got more than $18 million.
Oh my God.
Because every few years, the NBA renegotiates their TV contracts with TV networks, ESPN and ABC and whatnot. And so the dollars keep going up and up and up and
up.
Yeah. By the years 1998 to 2002, that 4 years netted them $50 million, the Silnas. Again, for just having once owned a team.
Wow.
Yes, for having
once
owned a team.
They don't have to pay any players.
Yep.
They just,
that's right. There's no insurance costs. There's no liabilities for these guys. They don't have to put the money in.
When does this end?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Karen. So now, as the NBA is making more and more and more money, you know, and the teams, those four teams in particular, are like, look, this sucks. We hate this. They tried on multiple times to basically buy the Silnas out. Say, look, guys, what will it cost to just sever our arrangement? Finally, in 2014, the NBA put an end to this agreement. They negotiated a deal. They were extremely, extremely anxious to negotiate this because the TV right deals expired after the 2015-16 season, which meant that it could be an entirely new contract.
And it could be more.
That's right. Oh, it would be more. You guys can probably guess what happened in the mid-2000s, late 2010s that made these dollar amounts go up, which is streaming rights, digital rights, web streaming. At this point, by 2014, from 1976 to 2014, the Silnas had collected about $300 million from the league in TV rights. The NBA
that's so
came
many
to them,
Bobby Bonillas together.
So that is, you could buy a lot of Bobby Bonilla Day contracts.
Wow.
With that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the NBA came to the Silna brothers in 2014 and said, we would like to give you $500 million to walk away from this contract. And the Silna brothers said, yes, we will take your $500 million and we will walk away. So yeah, all told, the Silnas recouped here over $750 million over the years.
Wow.
For the truly, truly passive income of once owning the St. Louis Spirits.
Because at some point, it's like you have to figure the NBA is going to get sick of paying them and they're going to just stop paying. And then it's going to be like, okay, sue the NBA, you know? And then you don't want to get into that. So if they come to you and they say, we're going to buy you out, like maybe you should do it.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. And, you know, Ozzy Silna, the elder of the two brothers, was you know, he was getting older. He did, in fact, pass away just a couple years after they ended this contract.
He's keeping him alive, this 83. Deal. 83,
that's right. Yeah, hey, man, that's all Daniel Silna's and family's money now, right?
I wonder if they would have taken a basketball teams, team. Guys. If they were like, we'll give you a basketball team, so now you have to earn it, but you can't.
You know what, Dana? Yeah. Like, if you take the brothers at their word, I really do think they would have. I really do think it really sounds like they really, really wanted to own. They had tried actually to buy the Detroit Pistons before they got into the ABA. So they really, basketball was in their blood. It just didn't work out the way they thought, but boy, did it work out in another way.
All right. I have a quiz for y'all today about the most watched events in the world, most watched on TV events in the world. So these are all things of world interest that happened, and they are like where most countries watch these things happen. It all felt like, oh, we should actually know this because this will come up in trivia, pub trivia.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
these do.
So I'm going to let each of you have a chance to crack these questions or do a write-in. All right, first question. So sporting events make up the highest global TV broadcasts of all times, but which sporting event type is the current global record holder with 3.6 billion views?
Okay. I think I've got a guess.
Okay, what are your answers? Okay.
I put the cricket finals.
I would put forth the Olympics opening ceremonies.
Oh.
Put the FIFA World Cup. Yeah.
It's the Summer Olympics specifically the ones in London and in Rio both got 3.6 billion viewers.
Wow.
And the FIFA World Cup in Russia was very close, not quite as popular as the Summer Olympics.
Okay.
That's a lot of dang people.
Okay. In 1969, 600 million people watched this event on TV around the world. What event was this?
1969. Okay, I have a guess.
I have a guess.
Let's hear it.
I put the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
I put the moon landing.
Oh!
What else?
I immediately like Chris's answer better, but I wrote Super Bowl I.
It was the moon landing.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
Yeah.
Okay. In September of 1997, 2 billion people worldwide tuned into which non-sporting event? 2 billion people tuned in to watch this in September of
1997. Oh.
2 billion people watched this in September of 1997, and it is a non-sporting event?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. I have my guess.
Oh, I have a guess, too.
I wrote Princess Diana's funeral.
I also wrote Princess Diana's funeral.
Yes, it was Princess Diana's funeral. And her 1981 wedding to Prince Charles was watched by 1 billion people.
Wow, that's... Oh.
Yeah. In 1973, 1.5 billion people around the world watched the concert Aloha from Hawaii via satellite. Who was the headliner?
Okay.
I put Elvis Presley.
I, too, put Elvis Presley.
I put Elvis P, which I'm hoping
I need the complete name, Chris. I'm sorry. No, Mockingjay Part 2.
The Fellowship of Presley.
I looked it up and I was like, well, how many TVs were in the world? Or how many people lived in the world? So in 1973, there were 4 billion people in the world. And 1.5 billion of them watched this concert.
I think that when they do these kind of huge number-y kind of things, though, it's like there's people all over the world where, like, you know, 8,000 people will all get together and, you know, around watch one TV, one. You know, so you know what I mean? Like when they calculate it. Yeah.
So the number could be higher. But this was his the soundtrack from this concert was his last big seller of an album. This was kind of near the end of his career. Let's see. In 2015, the World Cricket Cup is estimated to have been seen by 2.2 billion people. And one particular match was viewed by 1 billion people. India is one of the countries who is in this match that was viewed by a billion people. Can you name the other team? I had to change this question because of the Trivial Pursuit one before about...
You had to rewrite it?
Yeah, about cricket. I was going to say name one country, but...
Okay.
I have a guess.
My guess is UK.
Oh, see, I had it down to 50-50, and I went with Pakistan. Pakistan, yeah.
Yeah, that's...
I'm going to go with the UK, just because, yeah, why not?
Stick it up to the man.
It's Pakistan.
Ah,
okay. Yeah. Okay, between 1974 and 1980, Muhammad Ali fought in a series of high-profile boxing matches that were routinely viewed by like 1 to 2 billion people around the world. Mm-hmm. What was the name of his first 1 billion viewer match, and who was he fighting?
So what was the name of the match?
Mm-hmm. They all had names because, they promoted the heck out of them. That's why billions of people watched them.
I feel like it's 50-50 on the match for me.
Me too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Which one came first?
Yeah, exactly.
I put Thrill in Manila and George Foreman.
Okay. Mm. I put the only two that I could remember, which were Rumble in the Jungle. I think that was one. And Frasier.
I think we're going to have the variety pack here. I hope I
Rumble,
have the
Jungle
correct
Foreman.
Combination. I put Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman.
Oh.
Yes. Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman.
All right. Yeah. All
that
right.
One, and then the very next year was the Thrilla in Manila. Two more questions. In January of 2009, which U.S.-related event was viewed by 1 billion people around the world?
I got this one, Dana. 100%. Okay. That's how confident I am.
I mean, I don't know about 100%, but I wrote something down.
U.S.-related 2000. Okay. My guess is election? That wasn't even an election year.
You're in the right ballpark,
okay.
I think.
Okay.
I put down the inauguration of Barack Obama.
I too put down the inauguration of Barack Obama.
Yes, the first inauguration of Barack Obama was viewed by a billion people.
Wow.
Yes. Okay, and last question. Which TV show that ran between 1989 and 2001 pulled in an estimated 1.1 billion viewers per week around the world during its run?
1989 to...
How?
Isn't it bananas?
That is really crazy.
How?
I feel pretty confident in my answer.
No, I have a blank. I don't have a guess.
Colin,
you seem sure.
I feel confident. I'm not 100%. I'll say 99. I'm going to guess Seinfeld.
It is Baywatch.
Oh!
No!
It's Baywatch. Wow. David Hasselhoff.
Amazing.
Superstar.
Amazing.
Everybody in the world wants to watch people run around in their bathing suits. That's
Baywatch.
I guess that was too long for Seinfeld. They didn't run that long. Yeah,
yeah,
12 years.
But still, I wouldn't even imagine that
incredible.
Many people. I don't even know anybody who actually watched Baywatch.
I watched it.
I remember there's a period in the 90s where it was like the running joke about how it's like the most watched show in Germany and the most watched show in this and that in the other country. And I guess it wasn't a joke. I guess it was,
Equals 1.1 billion people watching it every week.
Oh, wow.
That was amazing.
Good job, David Hasselhoff. All right. I have a last quick quiz. And I also have a listener challenge at the end. This is very short. I was hoping that I could make this a bigger quiz, but I have four very good questions for you guys. I loved WandaVision and also the idea of being trapped in a TV show. And so here I have a very quick quiz. I've compiled specifically... movies about being trapped in another movie, in a fictional movie or in fictional show.
Okay.
So here we go. When we talk about, of course, people being trapped on a TV show, the go-to example nowadays and reference is Truman Show. Mm. Fantastic film. Tell me, what is Truman's last name?
Oh, man.
It is related to the fact that he was born. His last name is probably a city name where he was born in. And he was probably born in a studio.
Okay.
Is it Burbank?
It is Burbank.
That's
His
great.
Name is Truman Burbank.
Wow.
Burbank, okay. California. I believe that is where... ABC, WB, mm-hmm. a lot of the
Disney.
TV sound sets, mm-hmm. Our sound stages are Truman Burbank.
Did you pull that out of the punch bowl, Dana, or did you just reason that out?
I reasoned it out. It was like, awesome. I was going to say Los Angeles, and I was like, no, I think it
specifically. Yeah,
nice.
Good job. All right,
Musician Fiona Apple covered the Beatles song Across the Universe. The song and the music video did very, very, very well. And this song was released as part of what movie's soundtrack? I'll tell you some of the people in this movie.
Yeah.
Jeff Daniels, William H. Macy, and the main stars are Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire. What movie about trapped in a TV show is this?
Oh, it's,
Colin.
Is it Welcome to Pleasantville?
It is Pleasantville.
Yeah. Pleasantville. Well, okay, also, okay.
Fantastic movie about, especially being trapped in a black and white TV show.
That was a good one. I enjoyed that one more than I thought I would. I remember at the time. The soundtrack is
fantastic. It's it has Big Bopper, it has Buddy Holly, it has this song, it has a score was by Randy Newman. Fantastic soundtrack. All right. Little kid Danny is trapped in a movie whose main character's name is Jack Slater, and he works for the LAPD. What movie is this about being trapped in a fictional universe? Colin.
Is this Last Action Hero?
Correct. Is Last Action Hero, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger as Jack Slater.
Yes.
I believe the movie he's trapped in is Jack Slater 5 or 6. Apparently. Obviously a spoof on Arnold himself and on tropes about being an action hero.
Yeah. And had the always great Charles Dance in it as the villain.
Yes!
Tywin Lannister.
Tywin Lannister was the villain. Very good. Okay, and lastly, this is one of my favorite movies. In what movie comedy was John Ritter trapped in a demonic cable TV world featuring spoofs like Beverly Hills 90666, Murder, She Likes, Dwayne's Underworld, and Driving Over Miss Daisy?
Yeah.
Chris.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
Yes. So then the speakers is not included.
That's
since.
Different. Yes.
I love it. Eugene Levy's in it.
I should rewatch this.
There are other fantastic list of spoofs. Three Men and Rosemary's Baby. Autopsies of the Rich and Famous. But I really like Murder, She Likes.
This is a movie that basically just came out of a writer's room, just spitballing show titles. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And speaking of action movies, guys, I have a listener challenge here. And what I'm going to do before we end the show, I'm going to play clips of five songs. Five songs. There's a reason why they're together. They have a theme that they all share. If you know the answer, tweet at us, share on our Facebook what you think the answer is. Maybe give us an image or a meme or something. I'm not going to give too many more clues, but here we go. Here are the songs.
One night in a disco on the outskirts of Frisco, I was cruising with my favorite gang. The place was so boring.
Trying your best to bring the water to your eyes, thinking it might stop her from whipping your behind. That place go days, good, come back for smoke. Why did those days
shining through.
to make those rainbows in my mind. When I think of you sometime, and I want to spend some time with you, just the two of us. We can make it if we try, just the two of us.
All right, you guys, if you know the theme, hit us up on Twitter, on Facebook. Send us some fun memes, some pictures, some references. Let us know. And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about the Silnes Brothers, about funny movie summaries, about most watched events, about game shows, and of course, about being trapped in a TV. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, and on all podcast apps. And on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.